Welcome to The Big Table with me, Philip Limbury, where I meet some of the leading lights in the future of food and farming. Today, I'm talking to Tony Juniper, Campaigns Director at World Wildlife Fund, about how he's feeling in his new job, why food has become central to WWF's campaigning, and about his new book, Rainforest, Dispatches from Earth's Most Vital Front Lines, and about how he manages to stay so positive.
It feels quite daunting just because of the scale of the organisation and the complexity of it. Also hugely exciting as we try to plot a credible plan forward to try and avoid the ecological catastrophe that's now on our doorstep, both in terms of climate change and the mass extinction of animals and plants that's taking place, plus the degradation of the ecosystem that we depend upon in terms of soils and fresh water, for example. So there's a kind of excitement mixed in with an enormous challenge in front of us. But I do feel as though we're making some breakthroughs here in terms of us understanding the need to change gear, not only in this organisation, but across the wider environmental movement. Because what we've been doing over the last 50 years and longer is we've been having a very detailed documenting of the decline that's going on. We've got very good science now to show us the scale of it, and we've probably slowed it down in different places, but that's the best we've done, is to slow it down. We've now got to try and stop this and reverse it, which means we've got to get into the fundamentals of what's going wrong here rather than treating symptoms, and that is hugely exciting.
Tony, it's interesting that you pick up on decline because Compassion in World Farming, of course, we've noticed the decline too, and the denuding of the countryside has been about both wildlife disappearing, birds, bees, butterflies, mammals, and also farm animals. The farm animals have been disappearing over the last 40 years or so, and it's what's been marked is that in this era of factory farming, the world has lost half of its wildlife. And the two things, factory farming and wildlife declines, to me, very much go hand in hand. And the food system does have a major part to play in that. And I think this is where I find great common cause with what you're doing at WWF. And I'm so excited that you're involved here.
Well, it's great to be able to work with organisations that are embedded in that side of life, in the food system, and trying to understand some of the challenges therein. This is not least because the science that we've done here at WWF has revealed pretty clearly that the biggest single cause for the decline of wildlife that you're describing is the food system. And there are many faces to this. The use of pesticides, we've been very successful at controlling other life forms in farmed landscape to the point now where in most fields the only thing left is the crop. We've also been using those crops to be feeding animals in cages rather than animals on pasture. That then in turn has led to demand for more land, causing deforestation. We've had the intensification of farming causing soil damage, leading to runoff from fields, taking sediments and nutrients into watercourses and into coastal waters, causing immense ecological damage to aquatic and marine wildlife. So it's layer upon layer, of impact coming from the food system. And on top of that, you have, of course, immense quantities of greenhouse gas emissions, both coming from soil damage as well as deforestation, plus methane from animals. And so, again, a further ecological impact of a really quite profound kind. And so for us, the food system is now front and centre of what we need to do if we're going to not only stop this decline, but reverse it. And so it's going to be a very exciting time for us in finding common cause with the many other actors involved in the food system. And in fact, if you think about it for a nanosecond, everybody is involved in the food system, everybody who eats, of course. So this has got a very strong public component, obviously lots of work we can be doing with other organisations like Compassion in World Farming, but also, of course, across the private sector, because pennies are beginning to drop in different companies, looking at ways in which we might radically transform the impact. And I know one of the things that you and I have talked about a little bit is non-meat meats, as it were, and some of the technologies now available to be able to produce things that taste and look and feel like meat, but which actually are made from plants. And so there's lots of stuff coming together all at once, and it could be a very exciting time.
Absolutely, and I think that it's not readily apparent to policymakers or people in the general public, essentially, that nearly half the usable land surface of the planet is devoted to growing our food, and that 80% of that land space is producing meat and dairy, which contributes little more than a quarter of our entire protein needs as humanity. That, you know, here and now, and for all of written history, most of our protein has come from plants. And I think now the future very much is about trying to rein in our runaway meat and dairy consumption. That's not to say that all of us have got to go vegan, although that's a fantastic choice, particularly if the plants are coming from organic non-chemical systems. But it is to say that, you know, we do need more balanced diets, and certainly in the West, those unbalanced diets, heavy in meat and dairy, particularly from factory farms, is leaving us with a big price to pay environmentally and in animal cruelty. I think what I learned through writing Dead Zone, my most recent book, which you very kindly given some kind words towards, is that factory farming is not only the biggest cause of animal cruelty on the planet, it's also a major driver of wildlife declines. What that gives is individuals a great way, actually, of getting involved and not only helping to reduce animal cruelty but also save wildlife at the same time through the food choices that they make, eating more plants, less meat and milk, and better meat and milk from organic free-range and pasture-fed systems. And you mentioned the role of intensification and the food system in terms of deforestation, and your new book, Rainforest, is all about your 30-year journey to save those rainforests. Tell us about that. What has food got to do with rainforests, and what has your journey felt like for you?
Well, that's a good question, Philip. And so the simple answer is, in terms of what has food got to do with tropical rainforests, it's everything. Because this is now, simply put, the biggest cause of deforestation. Mm-hmm. And when I began this work 30 years ago, we were very focused on the timber industry and the effects of slash and burn farming, yeah, which actually was for food, but for small scale agriculture. The big shift in emphasis over that three decades that I've seen in terms of the causes of deforestation is this now preponderance of impacts coming from commodity crops. And so oil palm has been in the news a little bit lately in the UK, with major companies now saying they want to avoid palm oil in their ingredients. This is by far the single biggest cause of deforestation in Asia. And if you look across into Latin America, cattle farming has historically been a very powerful driver of deforestation in Central and South America, and now is being added to by the growing of animal feed supplying factory farms across the planet with crushed soya beans to feed pigs, chickens and cattle. And so the scale of impact has gone up, and this is in large part down to how we're feeding ourselves. And, you know, you can see strong connections through to the livestock industry in particular. Not only that, but that's definitely a big bit of it. And so, you know, the longer we've gone on as well, when I first began on that, you know, it was very much a question of species and indigenous peoples, and, you know, those concerns remain in terms of the impacts of deforestation in the tropics. But now we know this is a challenge with global ramifications from the point of view of water security and also global climatic stability, because these systems are not simply passive recipients of rainfall and just sitting quietly and not interacting with the rest of the global planetary system. They're fundamental to it, almost the beating heart of the planet, if you will, in terms of pumping water into the atmosphere that's travelling thousands of miles, watering crops in North and South America from the Amazon, for example, and also hoovering up vast quantities of carbon, including that coming from fossil fuels. And so we're causing ramifications for our human system that we're only just beginning to appreciate. And I tried to record some of that in the book, and just to unpack the growing understanding of all of this as time has gone on, because the science is still bringing new revelations as to how these things work. Driving planetary scale air circulation, for example, is one piece that's now being investigated. As these forests are pumping moisture into the atmosphere, they're driving the Hadley cells, which are at the heart of the Earth's atmospheric circulation. And so what does it mean for us in the human world as we destroy this particular piece of the system? We simply don't know. But at the moment, we consider it as being completely rational to cut down large swathes of these fundamentally important parts of planet Earth's function to feed pigs and chickens in factory farms. This is madness, to put it mildly.
Yeah, I remember quite recently, actually, being in Brazil, and I was in the savannah, or what's left of it. I was standing in Emmaus National Park, and I remember walking through waist-high grasses, through twisted trees and springy bushes, and there was birds calling everywhere, insects pinging past and scuttling away. And it was like nature's last stand. I was in this national park. Behind me was this rich ecosystem. There were even jaguars in there, although I didn't see those. And ahead of me and all around was just a desert of newly planted soya that had been soaked in chemicals, pesticides, and what have you. And it, nothing was there but the crop. And you know, that soya had been planted on previous savannah grassland that had been turned into cattle grazing. The former cattle owners had gotten a lot of money through selling their land, a lot more than they would have done if the before the soy industry came in, and they've up sticks and moved into the rainforest, causing further deforestation and all of this because we're growing soya as a high protein food, not for people, but for factory farmed animals, many of them in Europe. And I know how that made me feel. It made me feel sick, just stood there looking out at this landscape. And tell me how you felt when you've come face to face with the consequences of industrial food production.
Well, seeing the consequences in that way, and I've travelled through the savannas in central Brazil as well, and actually it's very much part of the plan here is to be focused on soya as one of the key commodities we'll look at, including because of these impacts on the rainforests and Cerrado woodlands of central South America. And that's something that hopefully we can get some traction on here, not only because of the livestock farming with pigs and chickens, but also the salmon industry, actually, and some of this stuff being fed to captive fish now as well. So how does all this make me feel? Well, I try not to get too upset by it, because I intend to continue doing this work for a long time. And I think one of the things you have to do is to not get too angry or too sad about it. Otherwise, either you get depressed or pessimistic, or you have to pack it in. So I tend to feel optimistic at every turn in order to be able to maintain the necessary energy and forward motion needed on all of this. I welcome the insight, but I try not to get too personally upset by it. And another very important part of maintaining the optimism, of course, is to focus on the positive as well as to be motivated by the negative. And in that book, Rainforest, Philip, I've tried to document in there as many examples as I can of things that actually are working. Because I think if we're going to be able to succeed with all of this, one of the things we have to convey to everybody is a sense of hope. And doom can take us so far, of course, but we need to inspire people with some true sense of possibility. And so in there, there's the example, for example, of Costa Rica, a country that decided to reorient its economy to be not causing deforestation, but to be doing reforestation. And over a 30-year period, that country, because of the way in which they looked at economics differently, they doubled their GDP at the same time as doubling their forest cover. A great example of how you can do this, and you see value from healthy forest rather than value from destroyed forest. It's a great example. And the good thing about that is that it's not theoretical. They actually did it already, and so other countries could do that. Looking at other parts of Latin America, very good examples of how what I describe in the book as the best forest custodians can be empowered. So the indigenous people who've been living in the forest for thousands of years, if they can get political control of the forest rather than the loggers and the ranchers and the miners, then the forest will remain there. And so in Colombia now, you have an area the size of the United Kingdom now under indigenous control. And actually, as a result of progressive politics there, new national parks being designated, literally a million hectares plus. This is incredible work going on in a country which, you know, has come from some quite tricky circumstances, but nonetheless has been showing leadership. And then on the global stage, you've got the UN RED process, reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation. British government has been a big backer of that, putting in hundreds of millions of pounds in order to be able to help countries go on this low deforestation journey. And then literally hundreds of companies now adopting zero deforestation targets in their supply chains. And this is going to be of enormous interest to you and I in our work, because this will include some of the companies, of course, that have got industrial meat production in their supply chains. So some of the fast food companies, I should think you and I are going to see them quite soon, because the zero deforestation dates they set themselves are coming up. And but nonetheless, the fact that they felt willing to do this and have put money and effort behind it is enormously encouraging. And then some of the smaller scale farmers I visited in West Africa who are trying to grow cocoa for global markets, being empowered by some of these companies who are making these kinds of pledges to get more out of their land in order to be able to protect the forest. Very inspiring, joined up approach towards poverty reduction and forest conservation. So all the examples that we could hope for, I think, already exist in one form or another. And so now I think it's really about spreading awareness about that and inspiring people to see that we can actually do this. I mean, this is not something which is inevitable. It's a choice. And actually, the other choices not to deforest are actually more attractive than the choice of deforestation. And not only from the reasons of ecology, but for economy, stability, resilience and security.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And focusing on the positives and the progress that we're making is so important. And certainly at Compassion in World Farming, in the animal welfare sphere, we've worked with over 800 companies, many of them big companies, a few small ones, all over the world, really, but particularly in Europe, in America, in China. And what's been really great is seeing how companies are embracing change, embracing animal welfare in the instances we're talking to them about, which is making commitments for wholesale switches away from cage eggs to cage-free, free-range and so on, away from mega dairy milk, intensively produced milk, to pasture-fed, pasture-grazed milk, these kind of things. So these can be big changes, and we've seen over the last 10 years, we've seen companies make commitments. We've worked with companies to make commitments that are now benefiting more than a billion animals a year with better lives. And I think what's really exciting is how we're now able to marry the animal welfare side of things with environmental conservation and benefits to humanity. And I do hope that you and I will be knocking on the same doors, perhaps even together, I hope together, to talk to them about their forestation targets and other things of this nature. I think there's exciting times, exciting synergies.
I think this is totally right, Philip, the extent to which all these things are linked together, because any of these big issues you look at, they've always got some connection through to something else. And I remember you and I speaking years ago about climate change and animal welfare and the extent to which we needed the joined up approach, because very likely some people might begin to make an argument that industrial meat production was going to be low carbon in some way. And so to be able to anticipate that and point to the need for joined up solutions rather than one that trades off against another. And, you know, even if that was correct, which it probably wouldn't be, it wouldn't be right in most people's eyes to tolerate these kinds of conditions for farm animals and to justify it through a CO2 prism. So we do need to make sure that the animal welfare and the conservation arguments are aligned and where people can see the connections between them, because the deforestation that is going on the other side of the world is very much a part of the same picture, which is enabling industrial livestock farming in this part of the world. So we do need to keep these things together as much as we can to paint a picture of joined up and integrated solutions rather than picking one bit and presenting that as better when in fact it's got downside somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that being able to articulate that factory farming has two sides. It's not just where the animals are caged, crammed and confined. It's also where they're their feed is grown, be it soya or cereals or palm or whatever it is, that's being grown on agricultural land, which essentially, if it's expanded, which it is being expanded, comes at the expense of forests. And this is what I say to people here: if we expand farmland, then essentially we're condemning forests to to the saw. Either locally or very often on other continents, and we're outsourcing that environmental damage as a nation here in Britain, as a community in Europe, outsourcing it to South America, to Brazil, Argentina, and the places that you write about so powerfully in your new book. So I'm heartened by how the synergies are coming together, and I think that that was very clear at the Extinction and Livestock Conference in London, and I felt that we'd found a way of bridging the gap between conservation, environmentalism, and animal welfare.
Well, this was a WWF Compassion in World Farming joint venture, wasn't it? And,
it was.
And hopefully enabled more people's eyes to be open to the connections between some of these things. And I remember you and I talking of connections just a couple of weeks ago, we were at an event about soil conservation. And I guess a lot of people would wonder, why is Compassion in World Farming at a soil conference? Why is WWF at a soil conference? And of course, again, the synergies right there once more are vividly seen, because some forms of industrial farming are damaging soils in order to produce cheap meat, in inverted commas. And for us in WWF, the more soil you damage, the more we have to look for new soil. And that new soil is presently underneath a tropical rainforest in many instances. And so again, you can start to see some of these fundamental pieces get unearthed as we delve into these questions. And in the end, we are almost every turn brought back to the food system as being at the heart of all of this in terms of the remedies. Actually, just one statistic that, we were thinking through here yesterday in terms of which bits of the food system lend themselves to some decisive action. And we were talking about food waste, of course, and the extent to which the world is presently wasting about one third of its food. And we were just reflecting on the extent to which that actually means the world is wasting one third of its land. It's the other way of looking at that. So we're producing food literally for bins, and one third of what we're producing, and those statistics you know very well about the number of millions of hectares under agriculture, one third of those millions of hectares are producing food for bins and for waste. It's literally literally incredible that this scale of environmental damage is going on right underneath our noses, and yet so little effort has been hitherto put into the food system as a solution to these big problems.
Absolutely, and I think that food waste issue is a really important one on so many levels. And it's not only land that's wasted, it's lives. We rear and slaughter about 74 billion farm animals every year across the planet, which essentially means with the level of meat waste that 12 billion animals get reared, slaughtered and binned, which is an extraordinary thought. Along with all the land, with all the the chemicals, the fertilizers, everything that goes with it, and there's another component to waste which I often talk about, which is the biggest single component of food waste on the planet, which is the feeding of human edible crops, cereal, soya, and the like, to farm animals, who then waste the vast majority of it in conversion to meat, milk, and eggs. What does the vast majority look like? Well, 26% is of our entire harvest is wasted in this way. We feed 40%, we get some back, but 26% is wasted through conversion into meat, milk and eggs. And that's really the heavy price that we pay, the hidden price we pay for industrial agriculture, for factory farming, for locking animals in cages, crates and confinement in a way which so many people at first glance think is a space-saving idea, a resource-saving idea, when actually it's quite the reverse. So with a nod to Earth Day and really saving the planet through reducing cruelty, we're reducing environmental damage. What's next for you at WWF?
So we're just putting together the big pieces of our new strategy, and over the next couple of months we'll begin moving towards some big outcomes that we hope to help bring about in 2020. So just 2 years away, there will be a series of global meetings on sustainable development and the Sustainable Development Goals, on climate change, and crucially for WWF's global network, a meeting of the Convention on Biological Diversity. Because what we're describing in the end from all of these different environmental subjects, and you touched on it, Philip, describing some of those trends in relation to wildlife, there's a mass extinction of animals and plants going on a scale not seen for millions of years. And so we need to now build momentum for an international treaty to stop it, a little bit like what we had in Paris on climate change, but we now need that to be happening for wildlife and nature. And those three big meetings on sustainable development, climate change and biodiversity, all occurring in 2020, is a big focal point for us. And one of the things that we will take into that discussion to get people to think about what we can be doing is really about our food, because the food is at the heart of all of this. We can't have sustainable development for nature and people unless we do something about the food system. We cannot stop the worst of climate change unless we do something about the food system. And we cannot stop, never mind reverse, the mass extinction unless we do something about the food system. So it's really a thread now for 2 years for us to build momentum to try and get some new global deals that are going to do this job of beginning the restoration of nature.
That sounds fantastic. And I think that you're clearly thinking down a very similar path to us. We're very keen to see governments talking about coming together for a global agreement to move away from factory farming, to end factory farming in all of its guises, in favour of a regenerative food system, a food system that's going to benefit the environment, its wildlife, its people, and without the cruelty. And so I think that anything that we can do to work together on that would be amazing. We're certainly looking more and more as an organisation to have dialogue with the United Nations, dialogue with key governments around the world and key corporations to try and build that momentum for, as you say, global deals, a global agreement, an overarching global agreement that the way that we produce our food, the way that we process and distribute and eat our food needs to change if we're going to have a decent future for our children. Thanks for listening to The Big Table with me, Philip Limbury, and I look forward to sharing new insights with you from the world of ending animal cruelty and saving the planet.